Coming up on this week's book show, best-selling author Francine Prose's latest is The Vixen. Set in the world of 1950s New York publishing, it's a story of a young man tasked with editing a steamy bodice ripper based on the recent trial and execution of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, an assignment that will reveal the true cost of entering such a world. Francine Prose on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Best-selling author Francine Prose's latest, The Vixen, set in the glamorous world of 1950s New York publishing, is the story of a young man tasked with editing a steamy bodice ripper based on the recent trial and execution of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, an assignment that will reveal the true cost of entering such a world. Francine Prose is the author of 21 works of fiction, including the highly acclaimed Mr. Monkey, The New York Times bestseller Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, A Changed Man, which won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Again, the new novel is The Vixen, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Francine Prose to this week's book show.
Thank you so much.
So nice to see you and to be here with you. I thank you very much. I love this novel and was so taken by it. And I realized two things. One is your ability to craft a story about something so horrible and yet have it be so accessible and really funny.
I can't tell you how pleased I am to hear you say that. It's been such a pleasure since the book has come out to have people understand that it's possible to do both those things at once. And I was filled with dread, really, that anyone would get that it was possible to write a comic novel that had, at least in the background, the Rosenberg case. But I've been very happily surprised.
Was the Rosenberg case something that you have wanted to write about for a while?
Yeah, for years. My mother was a high school friend of Ethel Rosenberg's. So her life and death was very much an issue in my family growing up.
The main protagonist, Simon, his mother grew up with Ethel Rosenberg. So there is that commonality in the fiction. I assume those autobiographical moments are well placed throughout.
Well, that family isn't my family exactly. And I grew up in a different part of Brooklyn. That takes place in Coney Island. And we were in what's now Ditmas Park. So it was different. But there are certain elements. I mean, Simon goes to Harvard, as I did, although it was Radcliffe then, and majors in folklore and mythology. And I majored in medieval English literature. So the experience of graduating from college and discovering that you've majored in a completely impractical subject was certainly autobiographical.
Let's talk a little bit about Simon. This character comes out of college. He has a degree. His parents are certainly very proud of him, and yet he comes out into the world. You open the novel on the day that the Rosenbergs are executed. Why was that a good place to start and to bring us to this point in Simon's life?
Well, it was the hardest part to write. That first chapter was the hardest and took the longest. And it wasn't until I wrote it that I could write the rest of the novel. But given that I knew that it was going to be a comic novel in many ways, I had to find it I had to find a way to make it clear that this was something that happened, and something really terrible that happened, and something reprehensible that happened, and just make that clear without being too expository about it. So the first chapter where Simon and his parents are watching it, or the prologue really, on TV, the way I could do it was realizing that I could intersperse it with little clips from the Lucille Ball show and the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson show, which, as I say in the introduction, were not on TV at the same time. Or do I think they were on this at the same time as the Rosenberg execution? But the rest of it was pretty much taken from life. I mean, there's a speech there that Bob Considine gives after watching the execution of Ethel Rosenberg that's on YouTube. I just basically transcribed what he said. He was quite shaken.
What was it about that event that shaped you, shaped your, I assume, your mother very much so, given the relationship, that would want you to explore it so many years later?
Well, it's something that stayed in the popular consciousness. I mean, it's been, you know, for example, the Tony Kushner play, Angels in America, right. And then, as people keep pointing out to me, the Doctorow novel and the Robert Coover novel. I mean, it's been, and that's just in things that have been written about it. I mean, there have been other things. So it was such a spectacle, and it was so awful to have that be part of an era when questions of guilt and innocence were so distorted, and when it seemed possible to execute a couple when their guilt had not been conclusively proven. Well, you know, no one knows what they did, really. It's been debated back with them. But in any case, it certainly wasn't clear what Ethel did or didn't do besides do some typing. So to be executed for that was just terrible. So it's a kind of, you know, it's one of those crimes in the history of the country that have stayed around. There are many of them that have just stuck in our consciousness.
And she remains the only woman to be executed for a crime other than murder.
Right, that's right.
Which says so much just in itself.
Yeah.
So we go to Simon, and you also get a chance to write about publishing, which certainly you know a thing or two about.
By now.
You bring this character to an established publishing house, and he's reading the slush pile, and then becomes an editor of this book, which is closely resembles the Rosenberg case. The names have been changed only slightly to protect those who have been executed. Give us a sense of that storyline, but also the idea of putting it into the hands of a publishing world, to have that be the side story.
Well, I'd always wanted to write about that because it's a vanished world, or mostly vanished world, but 1950s publishing. My first novel came out in 1973, and it was still basically the 50s as far as publishing, and it was still, there really were the three martini lunches and a very much an old boys club, an old white boys club, and I just kind of landed in the middle of that, and it stuck in my consciousness, of course, because it was so weird and so established and memorable. So I'd wanted to write something about that world. And it's impossible to trace how one thing leads to another. But I was also thinking a lot about authenticity and what's the real author, and what does it mean to write something, and why do we write things, and reading books apparently unrelatedly about the CIA and the so-called cultural Cold War that we wait, you know, sending Jackson Pollock exhibitions and Langston Hughes and Duke Ellington around the world as ambassadors of American democracy. So all those things somehow came together as the book unrolled, which after a point was what it felt like it was doing.
As Simon is navigating this world, he keeps on questioning the various things that he's done and of why am I in this position? My uncle got me this job. I don't know what I should be doing. My boss is taking liquor bottles out of hollowed out books behind him.
It's publishing, 1950s publishing.
And that is part of it. But then you get to take it to a fictional end, which is really remarkable. And also, this is a real thriller, a real mystery, too.
I wanted, you know, that New York Times interview has this sort of strange headline. I'm easily bored by books as writer of 22 novels.
Right.
But anyway, I love books that keep me engrossed and keep me wanting to know what happens. I mean, there are many other kinds of books that I love as well. I mean, Beckett, you don't read Beckett for the snappy surprises and plot turns. There's something else. But so I wanted to write one, and I felt like I've been moving closer to it. So that was part of the fun, too. I mean, every time the plot took some gigantic turn, it was exhilarating for me. The cyclone. I mean, the cyclone's a big part of the novel, the Coney Island ride. And I did want reading the book to feel like a version of that, of writing it.
That it is not the ride where the two characters have sex on, but did you consider it being...
No, that would be impossible and too public. Also, that you know these 1950s, well, 60s, 70s, these so-called dark rides in Coney Island. At one point, someone told me, and I have some memory of this, that they were 40 minutes long. That it wasn't like, you know, up on the cyclone and you know.
You had time.
You had time, yeah.
So you say in that the aforementioned article in the New York Times, the piece on you, I like to pretend that I'm the most attention deficit disordered person I'm ever going to meet. I'm very conscious of keeping the reader's interest, and I'm easily bored. I'm easily bored by books, I hate to say. And so I want there to be some sort of suspense or some sort of payoff. Are you constantly aware of that, or does that come through the revision process and rereading and saying, okay, this needs to be, or is that an active role that you play as a writer throughout the process?
Throughout the process. I mean, if I've got like two pages and I'm revising it and I just go, this is really boring, and I think so when I wrote it, so I'd be predisposed to like it, but I don't. I would find a way of cutting it or shortening it or something, just to, I mean, that, you know, the desire to just keep things moving in the novel was there.
The idea of the suspense that you allude to at the end, I mean, there is, as I said, it's a very suspenseful novel. There are major questions that you do not know until the end. So for you, how does that play out? Do you know that going in, or do you work on that as you go?
No, I knew that pretty much going in. I mean, the strange thing about this book for me is that there are spoilers, so-called. I mean, there really are plot turns, as you say, that happen and that I'm reluctant to talk about because part right. of the pleasure for readers is et cetera, et cetera. But the funny thing is that once you know something, you can't not know it. So I knew certain things about what was going to happen in the novel, and I knew that they had a certain historical basis, let's say. So I was afraid that everything that happens would be just incredibly obvious to anybody, because I assumed that everyone had read all the same books that I read and knew about the history in the same way. So I've been thrilled, really, that people think there are spoilers, that everyone doesn't say from the beginning, oh, yeah, right, that's what's going to happen. You know, not that it matters. I mean, there are other pleasures in the book, I hope.
So I'll give an example, and hopefully this isn't a spoiler in any way, but I didn't, this was a real thing that I was not aware of, which is the Jell-O box.
Uh-huh.
And you write about the Jell-O box, and this was a huge part of the case. And one of your characters has a relationship to the Jell-O box, which is fascinating. So by that, we also learn quite a bit. Or we can, if
well,
we decide to take it.
Yeah, as they say, you can't make this stuff up.
Right.
I mean, the Jell-O box, although that does come into question in the novel, but supposedly the evidence that the state had against the Rosenberg was this torn up Jell-O box, kind of a zigzag pattern that matched up with a Jell-O box that the spy contact had, and that was their way of establishing their identity. It's so patently absurd that people would be carrying around Jell-O box halves. Someone, if it didn't happen, someone made it up. And again, without spoiling anything, part of the book does turn on that question.
As you look at the overall issue, as it, I think you said this at the beginning, of course, the Rosenberg case is very much a part of the novel, but it's also very separate from it as well, because this is the story of this young man who is trying to make his way, and all kinds of weird things are happening.
Yeah, no, it is a coming of age story, and it is a story about a conscience, about developing a conscience, and having a job, and being asked to do something that you know is the wrong thing to do, and then having to decide whether or not you want to keep your job, or whether you want to do it, or whether you want to not do it. That's a pretty basic human dilemma in any era, I would think.
Francine Prose is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Vixen, and it is published by Harper. When it comes to the idea of Simon telling us the story, there are times where he alludes to the future and will say, I will come to learn later as I've come to learn when this happens to me. Do you think of that future as your writing of the character of what Simon's future is? Is
of
that
his future
design?
No, I knew it had to be written in retrospect for certain things because there are, you know, for one thing, I am now writing about someone who's like 50 years younger than I am, let's say. So, and having to remember back to what it felt like to be that age. So the idea of retrospect, in a way, had to be there, because certain things that seem really serious and important when you're 22 don't seem that serious and important 50 years later, and some things do. I mean, it just, so I had to have that element. But other than that, I mean, for example, Simon, in some way you feel, will write the book that's the book. I mean, that's how... Again, without spoiling anything, that's how it ends. But on the other hand, I don't know, will he have another kid? I mean, they once made a film out of one of my novels, Household Saints, and there was a panel, and all the actors, wonderful actors, were there, and they'd all thought ahead. They knew what their characters were going to do after the last moment of the film, you know, the last fictional moment. But I don't know. I mean, once they're, I miss my characters, but I don't know what happens to them.
There are three prominent women in the novel. He falls in love with all three of them.
Well, there are four. One's his mother.
Yes. Well, and I was going to get to his mother.
And he does love his mother. He loves his mother. I mean, I keep saying this, but he loves his mother, and it's not pathological. He's not Portnoy.
And I would add, I was going to bring up his mother and his father. He likes his parents.
He likes his parents.
He likes to spend time with his parents, and he's worried about his parents, and he's concerned about them. And you have all of the things that you have when you're young, and you're dealing with people who are older, and yet he likes to spend time with them.
He likes his parents, and they're funny. You know, that's, I mean, the scene of them watching the Rosenberg execution, and they're just, they're wisecracking in some strange way all the way through. And, you know, so I wanted their characters to be there again, right up front, so you could see who they were. But again, I think Simon's whole behavior throughout the novel is informed by the fact that he likes his parents and he does love his mother. And to feel that he is being asked to do something that would be deeply painful if his mother found out is a thorny one.
How did your mother take the execution?
She was very upset by it. I mean, they weren't, you know, I can remember it. I mean, I can't remember much about it, but I can remember the McCarthy hearings were on TV in our household, and we knew about Ethel's execution. I mean, my parents, in that way, my parents resembled the parents in the novel. I mean, they were Roosevelt Democrats, right? And they thought communists, they thought they were like naive or something. Or I mean, and my dad had these cousins who had been communists, and then they got rich and just exploited their workers. They had a factory. And my dad was saying like, oh, yeah, that's what it's like. And I'd think, geez, imagine talking about a whole political movement in terms of your cousins. But then I realized he really, that's what he meant. And as it turned out, you know, in the Soviet Union, it was pretty much like my dad's cousins. They wanted the fur coats and the best caviar and et cetera, et cetera. I don't think my father's cousins killed anyone the way they did in the Soviet Union, but
there is a moment in the book where you say, look, the Rosenbergs were Jewish, those defending them were Jewish, and those prosecuting them were Jewish.
Oh, the judge was Jewish, Judge Kaufman, and Roy Cohn was involved. I mean, he was the, you know, McCarthy's right-hand guy. I mean, he was around. I mean, Roy Cohn is one of those, well, just one of those zealot figures that keeps turning up in a very unpleasant way. I mean, that was one of the things about the Angels in America. I mean, to make that was terrific, to make that connection between Roy Cohn and the Rosenbergs.
And in that play and in the work, there are the conversations between the two of the ghost of Ethel who haunts Roy Cohn. Did you look at it as also something to explore how the Jews were perceived at that time in our history?
Well, I think there's never been a good time in which Jews have been perceived in our history. I mean, the new uptick in anti-Semitic crime is nothing new. Mm. It's just been going on all the time. I mean, on her deathbed, Edith Wharton is said to have said, "I'll never forgive the Jews." So that was Edith Wharton. I mean, one of our great writers. So on her deathbed. So it's not as if the 50s and McCarthy and the Rosenbergs were some strange aberration in American history. I think it's been there and is here.
But it is coming right after the war, right after the Holocaust, and everything is raw, right?
Yeah, well, everything is raw. And that is, I mean, it's certainly different for American Jews, but maybe, you know, maybe not. I mean, that's still very raw. It's still very raw. I don't know. I think it would be less, what do I want to say? I think it would be less public and less brazen. I mean, that kind of expression of anti-Semitism. Mm. But again, you know, it's not as if it's not as if there aren't always despised groups in our culture who get treated horrifically. I mean, that again, you know, that's not certainly limited to American Jews.
But the real devil for the characters in this book are the communists.
For the characters in this book, for certain characters in
yes.
this book,
yes.
for certain characters in this book. I mean, you know, but the father says, I think very early on in the novel, you could be a communist if you want to, just don't overthrow the government and you shouldn't have to die for it. Now, that seems like a reasonable...
It's the least you could do.
It's the least you could do. I mean, compared to McCarthy saying, we're going to root you out and expose
right.
you and ruin your life and you're going to lose your job. I mean, and that stuff was very real. I think just before I started really writing this, I saw The Americans, you know, that series on TV, and it was very helpful. I mean, very helpful in reminding me that was real. The Cold War had actually happened.
Francine Prose is our guest. The new novel is The Vixen. You get to write bad fiction in this.
On purpose.
Yes.
It was a joy. It was really fun.
And there's also the slush pile that has some great, just awful titles. And that seems to me like it's, oh, great author gets to play.
It was hilarious. I mean, I think it's hilarious, and it was hilarious to write it. I mean, do you remember the titles? Like The Igloo Lover was one, and then their little plot summaries. The Count of Monte Christmas, right.
Tears in the Apple Pie. The Laboratory Mice's Revenge. That's pretty good.
You know, titles for future novels. Who knows? You can imagine. If I could write The Vixen, The Patriot, and The Fanatic, I could probably write The Laboratory Mice's Revenge.
The Igloo Lover, as you mentioned, I, Barbarian, Mary M., where the summary is Magdalene loves Jesus unrequited.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, you can tell. It was fun to write that.
The one of the... one of the lines in the book of the fake book that you write is the prosecutor sensed her presence from all the way down the corridor, overpowering the usual prison smells, disinfectant, sweat, with the crazed perfume of estrus animal passion.
It's horrible. It's so terrible. But again, because it was so over the top and so terrible, I was really on the border of way over the top, and I was kind of persuaded to cut back some of it because there was originally a bit more of the so-called bestseller, and I had to cut it because a little of that goes a long way.
When you think of your writing life, what part does teaching play in that?
I have a great job. I love my teaching job. I teach in the fall semester. I teach a literature class. Not always on purpose, sometimes on purpose, sometimes accidentally, pick subjects. I mean, I change every year. I teach a different thing every year. So sometimes I'll pick subjects that are just things I've been interested in. So, for example, when I was writing Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, I taught a class about evil, about representations of evil in literature. And this coming semester, it's going to be about sympathy. It's called Sympathy for the Devil, which is in a bit of an unfortunate title because it's not just sympathy for the devil, it's also sympathy for human beings as well. So we're just going to look at a huge range of stories and novels and nonfiction and just look at the ways that the writer creates sympathy or doesn't create sympathy or doesn't bother to create sympathy or doesn't, or do we still like fiction in which no one is sympathetic? I mean, questions like that.
Do, in the exploration of that subject with your students, will that lead you, or do you want that to lead you to a place that will take you to the next novel or through the next novel?
Sometimes, sometimes not. Sometimes it's just interesting. I mean, it's never not interesting is the thing because my students are really smart and really good readers, and they always manage to find something that I didn't notice before, even if it's a story that I've taught before. So that's, and I'm always like incredibly excited when that happens. So I look forward to it again, and it's not, I never feel it's a burden. I mean, they write a paper every week, so like 300-page paper every week, each of them. So, and also I can work with them on their writing in a way that's very, excuse this word, organic, and doesn't mean they're handing in a 10-page paper at the end of the semester and not knowing how to write.
Distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. Francine Prose is the author of the new novel, The Vixen. It is published by Harper. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a great pleasure.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.